Hello, and welcome to Specimen Stories. My name is Clara Nordén. In this podcast, I explore some of the amazing and surprising science that emerge from natural history collections. If you've visited a natural history museum, you've probably been astonished by the displays of animals and fossils in the exhibitions. But these displayed specimens form only a small fraction of the total collections contained in a natural history museum. Large museums, such as the Smithsonian, have millions of specimens in their collections that are not on display, ranging from jars with preserved fish to taxidermy birds and fossil dinosaur bones. These collections form a record of the diversity of life on Earth and are an invaluable resource for scientists. But what exactly can we learn from natural history collections? What stories do the specimens tell us? In this series, we meet the scientists working with specimens and learn about the scientific discoveries they made working in the collections. Join me in exploring the hidden world of specimens. There is a saying that someone is eagle-eyed if they spot minute details. And if I asked you to name an animal with good eyesight, you'd probably think of an owl or an eagle. But in today's episode, we'll hear that the largest relative eye size of any vertebrate is found in an entirely different group of animals, frogs and toads. Kate Thomas, who is a postdoctoral researcher at the Natural History Museum in London, surveyed eye size in hundreds of frogs and toads and asked how eye size has evolved in this diverse group. Why do frogs and toads have such large eyes? How does eye size affect vision in the first place? And did you know that many frogs can see colors in the dark? Listen on for a deep dive into the frog's eye view of the world. Welcome to Specimen Stories, Katie.
Thank you.
It's great to have you here.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
We're going to talk a little bit about your research on frog eye size evolution. But before we kind of dive into the frogs, I'm just curious about how you got interested in this topic. So before you worked on frog eye size, you've also worked on the evolution of eyes in other animals, such as squids, for example. So what's so fascinating about studying the evolution of eyes in animals?
I think that when it comes down to it, for me, the sense of vision is really interesting because it's something that I think we rely on so much as humans that we can almost take it for granted that what we see is some sort of objective truth out in the world. And when you start learning about different types of animals and the different ways their eyes are built and the different genes that they have for things like color vision, and you realize that animals are seeing completely different worlds from each other and from us, it's kind of mind-boggling because it's this thing that seems very constant and real, and you realize that it's actually very much a quality of our specific eyes and our specific ability to perceive different aspects of light.
Yeah, no, that's really awesome. And I agree with you. I feel like it's almost a little bit philosophical in a way to work with this, because it's like, what is the world like to a frog? It's almost a philosophical question, but it's also science, because we can learn things about, you know, maybe not how this frog necessarily experience the color red or something, but it's still something amazing about learning about how this tiny little frog, for example, would see the world compared to us.
Yeah, and of course vision and is integrating a lot of different aspects about eyes and what they can perceive, and eye size is just one very, very tiny aspect of that, but it can still tell us some really interesting things about how animals might be potentially adapting to their environments.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about how eye size relate to vision, because it's a little bit more complicated than maybe you would expect. So, you know, perhaps a basic assumption is that if you have a bigger eye, you're going to have better vision, or you need a big eye to have good vision. But that's a little bit simplistic, because really, what aspect of vision are we really talking about? So there are two main maybe aspects of vision that are important, and one is sensitivity, or how well you can really pick up changes in light levels. The easiest way to think about this is how well do you see in the dark? How well do you see at low light conditions? And then the other aspect relates to acuity, which is more how well can you distinguish patterns? So how good is your resolution of that image that you get? So could you unpack a bit for us, Katie, how these two different aspects of vision, the sensitivity and the acuity, relate to eye size?
Yeah, so the first thing that's a bit important to understand is that sensitivity, which is detecting contrast, like you were saying, and acuity, which is detecting detail, like patterns, are kind of at odds with each other, because increasing sensitivity can be done by pooling information into bigger sort of buckets. Sometimes when I try to think about this, I think of like light photons, like little balls that you're throwing into an eyeball. And if you have bigger buckets in the eyeball, you'll catch more little photons per bucket. But those big buckets mean that you're not sampling, you're sampling quite a large piece of the world. So if you're thinking of it in terms of a pattern, all the information from one area of space is being received by just one receptor. And so you can't really tell where that ball came from. But if you have a bunch of tiny buckets, you get fewer balls per bucket, but each bucket is aimed at a more specific location in space. And then your eye can say, hey, I know that this photon came from that area. And so I don't know if that's the easiest, most unpackable metaphor, but basically when you try to increase acuity, you often sacrifice some sensitivity. And what increasing eye size can do is it can allow you to increase sensitivity or acuity or both without greatly sacrificing the other aspect.
Right. So if you want plenty of really big buckets, you're going to need a really large area for that. But also if you want, you know, hundreds and hundreds of these tiny buckets to have really good resolution, you would also need a lot of space for that. So it's kind of both of them require a big eye size.
Right. Yes. And it is sort of related to two other physical optical aspects of the eye, one of which is the focal length, which is just the same as a camera. So if you have a shorter focal length, you have higher sensitivity, but you have lower resolution in your pictures. So short focal length is good if you want like to take pictures in dim light, but then they can be kind of grainy. So that's like a small eye. If you increase focal length, you get higher resolution. And then if you think about sensitivity, the way that you can maximize sensitivity is by increasing the size of your aperture in photography, which is sort of like our pupil. So a bigger eye can allow you to increase both of those things, which can result in better vision on both axes.
Right. So this will all be really familiar to you if you work with cameras, because it kind of work in a similar way. So if you want to take images, in kind of low light condition, you'd want to open up your aperture to the maximum to let in all of the light. And the same is true for the pupil. And to some extent, the bigger your eye is, the bigger your pupil can be, and you can let in more light. So that makes your eye more sensitive. And then with the focal length, if you have a really long focal length, so for people who are not in photography, that's basically just the distance from the lens in the eye to the retina. If you have a long focal length, you can focus that image on kind of a larger area of your retina. And so that just allows you to put those photons that you're collecting from the image into more buckets and get a really high resolution image. All right. So I think we got some really good concepts in here, and I'm just going to shortly summarize them to see if I got them right. So if you want, well, both of you want high acuity, and if you want high sensitivity, either of those axes, you need a large eye, but for slightly different reasons. So for maximal sensitivity, you want a really big pupil. So you want a really big eye to accommodate for that, and a short focal length to concentrate all of that light onto a smaller area on your retina. While as if you want to maximize acuity, so how well you can detect patterns, then you want a large eye because you want a really long focal length, which allows you to focus that image on kind of a large area of your retina and getting those photons into many different buckets, so many different receptors, which gives you great resolution. Is that about right?
Yeah.
Great. Then let's move on to frogs. So first of all, why did you choose to study eye-size evolution in frogs specifically? Is there something particular about the lifestyle of frogs or their behaviors that makes them particularly interesting to study this question?
Yeah, so there's a couple of reasons. One was that when we started this project, it hadn't really been looked at a lot in amphibians. There was a lot of really foundational visual physiology work done in frogs and toads early on in the field of visual ecology. But in terms of sort of macroecology and visual evolution, there's been less work. That's rapidly changing. But the other reason is that frogs and toads just have a really amazing diversity of ecologies. So in terms of habitat, there are frogs, obviously, that live in like ponds and streams, which is what I always thought about frogs before I got into the field of herpetology. But there's also frogs that live in trees. There's frogs that live like almost entirely underground their whole life. There are some frogs that will burrow, but they're mostly active above ground. There are nocturnal species. There are completely diurnal species. They also make these really amazing transitions through ontogeny in terms of metamorphosis, though there are some frogs that don't actually have a tadpole phase.
Really?
So there's direct developing frogs. And there's also all kinds of weird ones that will like carry their tadpoles on their backs or do strange things like that. So throughout development and across ecology, there's just really interesting diversity in frogs that we would expect would place some interesting pressures on their eye evolution.
Yeah, because all these different frogs live in such different environment, right? So they would need really different eyes. So I guess we can outline some of the predictions that you had for frogs. So if we think about it, we already talked about, you know, you need a big eye, either if you want to be really sensitive to light changes in poor light conditions, or if you want to detect detailed patterns, for example. So one of the predictions you had was that you should have smaller eyes if you were like kind of a burrowing type of frog or if you were living in water. So unpack that a little bit for us. Why should these frogs have smaller eyes?
So part of the predictions hinge on the knowledge that vision is not something that our bodies can do for free. Everything that our bodies do costs energy, and the neural material of your eyes and vision and visual processing actually takes a lot of energy. So the bigger eyes that you have, the more tissue you have to support, the more information presumably that your brain is processing. So we expect that there is selection pressure against having big eyes because of this cost. And on the other side of that, we expect that there's selection pressure for big eyes because of these benefits we've talked about in terms of visual performance, like acuity and sensitivity. So the reason that we expect animals like fossorial burrowing frogs and maybe fully aquatic frogs that might be living in like murky ponds where not much light is penetrating is because they're probably not going to have great vision even if they have really big eyes. On top of that, things that are burrowing, they're crawling underground, big eyes bulging like you see in like tree frogs could actually be a physical problem for frogs like that as well. They could be at risk of getting scratched and infected and things like that. So
you get a twig in your eye all the time.
Yeah. And you do see in things like burrowing mammals a lot of eye loss and eye reduction. So that was kind of the basis of that prediction.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, if you're underground burrowing in twigs, like there's really no point having a really excellent vision because maybe you just rely on other senses instead. And I think it's interesting with this aquatic prediction because initially I was like, but why wouldn't you want good vision in water? But like you said, it's because a lot of frogs just live in really, really murky water. So it's very difficult to get any good. I mean, even if you had excellent eyes, you probably couldn't tell very much anyways, you know, maybe a few centimeters in front of your face, but not more than that. So that also makes sense.
Though there are some frogs that will, and this is a good example, there are some frogs that will sit in the water. They're fully aquatic, but they'll pop their eyes up, so just their eyes are sticking out of the pond. So actually, a lot of their vision is happening in air and in a very transparent optical medium. And those species tend to have bigger eyes than, say, something that lives near the bottom in a murky pond.
Right, right. Yeah, that makes sense. So let's talk about, what kind of behaviors or ecologies would you expect to have bigger eyes? We talked about some of the reasons why some frogs might have small eyes. What were your predictions for the groups that should have really big eyes?
Yeah, so we predicted that we were especially interested in scansorial species. So these are species like tree frogs and other species that will climb up in vegetation. They're often in very complex three-dimensional habitats up off the ground. Sometimes they're jumping between twigs. So you might expect that species like that might need to have really high acuity so that they can perceive all the fine detail in their environment and keep themselves from, say, falling out of a tree, for example. These species.
Do you
also
see that sometimes with tree frogs just falling off a tree? You know, they try to jump to a twig and then fail.
I have not personally seen that, but I haven't done a ton of herpetology field work. So that would probably be a good question for a hardcore field herpetologist. Yeah, so we also were thinking about some species that have what's called sexual dichromatism. And this can be kind of a confusing term because we talk about dichromatism in terms of vision often as having two different types of photoreceptors. But this is actually referring to males and females having different colors and patterns that they exhibit on their bodies. And it's thought to be a sexual signaling to the females. So we predicted that maybe species that exhibit this, because they seem to be more highly visual and they're relying on these visual cues in addition to things like auditory signaling for reproduction, we thought maybe these species would also be investing in larger eye sizes.
Right. So if you are specialized in attracting a mate with really nice colors or patterns, then you would expect these frogs to have really good eyesight, because otherwise what's the point with being pretty, right? If you can't see it.
And the last thing we thought was that perhaps species that are fully nocturnal, because they're active in such dim light all the time, basically, might have larger eye sizes than species that, say, are mostly diurnal and mostly active in bright light, where they might not need such big eyes to get all the photons that they can capture.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, when we think about mammals, that's the image I have in my head too, like these, you know, night living mammals with huge eyes to let in all light. So that makes a lot of sense. So you had all these cool now predictions for, you know, how eye size would evolve in frogs all frogs and toads. How did you go about testing this? How does one go about measuring eye size in frogs?
So I'm currently a postdoc at the Natural History Museum in London, which has a really extensive herpetology collection that includes a lot of frogs and toads. So I did this using museum specimens, which is great because it's this measuring eye size is something that you can do non-destructively. And it means that I didn't harm any of the specimens doing this research, but also I didn't harm any frogs or toads. I didn't have to go out and capture live animals to get data. I could just access this incredible resource that's been curated over hundreds of years in this museum. And the same specimens can be studied by hundreds of other people before and after me.
Can you explain to us just a little bit, what does it look like in a herpetology collection? So was this the first time you worked in, you know, a herpetology collection, or did you have previous experience with that?
Yes. So as you mentioned before, I studied squids for my PhD. So I've worked in collections before, but they were cephalopod collections. And when I started my postdoc, it was my first time working in herpetology and my first time at the Natural History Museum and my first time with that collection. It's actually really neat at that museum because they've set up an exhibit for the public to show the public what a collection looks like. So there's all these glass windows into one of the public galleries in the herpetology collection, which does make you feel a bit like a zoo animal when you're working in there. But yeah, you walk in and there's just rows and rows of fireproof cabinets with doors on them. And you open up the doors and there's jars upon jars upon jars of preserved frogs and toads, as well as things like lizards and snakes and salamanders. And they date back to the 1800s. There's some of Darwin's original specimens that he collected are in that museum. So it's a really history rich, and interesting place to poke around.
Wow. Did you have a favorite specimen that you worked with? Like something you like looked at that you were like looking at the label, who collected it and when you were like, oh, this is really cool.
I did measure data from a specimen that was from the 1800s, and I felt very honored to be using it, but also a bit terrified taking it out, making sure I didn't do any sort of damage to this amazingly old preserved piece of history.
Yeah, I would feel the same. And I'm just trying to picture this now. So I, you know, of course I work with specimens too, but those are bird specimens and kind of taxidermy skins. So it's like never a wet specimen, which I imagine that these guys are. They're kind of in jars.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So most of herpetology is wet. So they're preserved in jars of alcohol. Some of them are fixed first in something like formaldehyde. So they tend to be a bit stiff when you take them out. They aren't bendy, they're rigid in their shape.
And then you just took up your tape measure and measured.
I have some calipers, so I took some calipers and I'd measure the diameter of the eye, the diameter of the cornea, and then in frogs and toads, the measure of body size that's usually used is called snout vent length. So snout is like the tip of the frog's nose, basically, and vent is the back of its anus, I guess.
Right.
So, yeah. So you measure a line down the body. So I measure that and then I would weigh each specimen. And that was important because eye size doesn't evolve in a vacuum, right? Most things have eyes that are proportional to the size of their body in some way. So when we're wanting to understand how eye size evolves, we have to also understand how body size is evolving so that we can compare a corrected version of eye size rather than saying that a giant frog has giant eyes and a small frog has small eyes, which obviously is going to be the case.
Right, yeah. Right. You can't have like, there's a limit to how big your eyes can be if you are very small.
Yeah.
So you would expect some kind of correlation there.
Right.
That makes a lot of sense. So you measured these frog eyes across hundreds of specimens, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And of course you picked these across, you know, various different ecological adaptations that they had so that you can test your predictions.
Mm-hmm.
So once you had all these amazing data, what did you find? Were there any of those correlations that you were looking for?
Yeah, so the main thing that we found and the thing that showed the strongest pattern across species was that the habitat that a frog occupies really has a strong effect on its relative eye size. So I just mentioned that we have to consider body size as well. So so if you consider how big a frog's eyes are given its body size, habitat has a really strong effect on that. And like we predicted, things that tend to burrow underground have really small eyes. Things that do some burrowing, but just mostly under things like leaf litter and come out sometimes, they have intermediate sized eyes, and then things that are fully above ground have the biggest eyes. We also saw, as we predicted, that aquatic things tend to have quite small eyes.
Yeah, that's really nice. And it must have been very satisfying for you as a researcher to kind of find these effects that you were expecting. So you did find that frogs and, you know, aquatic or burrowing behaviors have smaller eyes, well as frogs that live in trees and above ground have bigger eyes. And that, of course, also makes a lot of sense. Another thing that you were interested in and that you predicted was that frogs with bigger eyes, or rather frogs that are more colorful or maybe use color in mating displays and to attract a mate, would have bigger eyes as well, because you would need those large eyes to spot these nice colors. Was that something you found in your data as well? Did you find a positive correlation there?
So The one specific thing that we did test was whether frogs that exhibit sexual dichromatism, where males and females are colored differently, and that's thought to be for sexual signaling, whether they have bigger eyes than species that don't have that. And we did see a slight trend in that direction, but it was not significant in our statistical models. Sometimes you get a null result due to an issue with power. So I wouldn't say that we have definitive evidence that that's not something that's happening, but we don't have any evidence to support that currently.
I see. But that leads me to another question on color, though. So I'm gonna keep us on this track just for a little bit, just because I'm a bit obsessed with color, since it's what I work on. Where would your instinct be for where we find the most colorful frogs? So would that be in the cases where we have these sexual dimorphism cases where frogs use it for signaling to another frog? Or is it in other situations? Because there are certainly a lot of colorful frogs out there. But I'm not sure where that, you know, how that color is really used in frogs as compared to something like birds, for example.
Yeah. I mean, you do see there are some really, really colorful frogs that are diurnal. And I think their coloration is thought to be warning coloration. I'm trying to think about their eye sizes. I don't think they have particularly large eyes, but I suppose if your color is directed at other viewers, you wouldn't necessarily expect your own eyes to be adapted to that signal.
Right. That's interesting, because since I study birds, if I think about where I would find the most colorful birds, I would probably think in situations where there's really strong sexual selection and the males have these really crazy colorful displays. Like, maybe that would be my intuition for where we would find the most colorful birds. But with frogs, you have all of these amazing diversity of colors with frogs that are apocymatic, so they're just trying to show off that they're poisonous, essentially, don't eat me. It's not to show off to another mate. And of course, then you wouldn't expect that the frog itself needs to see those pretty colors so well. It only needs to be visible to the predator who may eat that frog.
Yeah. Another interesting thing when you're thinking about color vision in frogs is that, and this ties back to what I said at the beginning about sort of our perceptual world and how it informs how we think about other animals. Humans are colorblind at night because we only have one type of rod. And so as light gets dimmer and dimmer, we lose our color vision and we focus exclusively on contrast discrimination. Which is true for a lot of animals, but frogs and toads actually have two different types of rods. So they have color vision at night.
That is amazing. I did not know that.
Which again, because then you're jamming in two different types of receptors, there is considerations for that when you think about something like the evolution of eye size. If you're trying to do a lot of color discrimination at night, again, having a large eye is probably very beneficial. And a lot of the species that we see that do have things like sexual dichromatism are also nocturnally active. So if they're using that for mating, they're probably mostly doing that in the nighttime when you have a severe light limitation. I think that's really interesting for thinking about the evolution of color too, because that's a very different environment for color vision to be taking place than in a bright daytime environment where you have an overabundance of photons and a broad spectrum of light.
That is really interesting and super cool. I did not know that frogs had color vision, or at least some frogs have color vision at night. And maybe that's related to as well why they, as a group, have such large eyes. So we've talked already about how, you know, certain groups have smaller eyes or bigger eyes depending on what habitat they live in. But you also found with your data that frogs and toads as a group tend to have really large eye size, relative eye size compared to their body size, compared to many other vertebrate groups. So you compared frogs and toads to mammals and birds and fish and reptiles. Frogs come out as having really the largest eye size. So do you think that these nocturnal habits may be one of the reasons why the group as a whole have such large relative eye size?
Yeah, so there are certainly a number of different reasons that frogs could have large eyes, but one thing that I find sort of interesting to think about is there's been some work done on the evolution of activity periods in frogs and toads, and there's pretty good evidence that the sort of ancestor of that group was probably nocturnal. And even now across most extant species, most frogs and toads are nocturnal, or at least nocturnally active some of the time. And we know that nocturnal things generally tend to have big eyes because they're active in low light. You add the fact that a lot of frogs and toads are doing color discrimination in this low light on top of that, and it does just sort of make intuitive sense to me that many of them would have big eyes. That said, we didn't see a huge effect of activity pattern on eye size in frogs. There was a bit of a difference across species, but it wasn't a very large magnitude difference. The habitat seemed to be a much better predictor of eye size. I really don't know. It's an interesting question.
Well, it's certainly intriguing, and it just adds to the mysteries of things we don't yet know about frog vision. And, well, you've certainly convinced me that we need a whole team looking at these questions, and I'm sure that's what you and your research colleagues are currently busy working on. So I'm super excited to hear what your research finds next. So I'd like to ask you just one final question to wrap up. Do you have a favorite frog or toad, Katie?
There's a really hilarious frog called a rain frog, and it sounds like a dog squeaker toy when it's trying to be really big and scary. It kind of puffs up and like stands on its legs and goes like, that has to be my favorite. It has nothing, like, it's not anything to do with its eyes. I think it's just a ridiculous creature.
I love that. We'll definitely put a video of this guy, if I can find it, on the with this episode. That'll be great. Well, thank you so much, Katie. This has been great. I've learned loads. So thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks for your great questions. It's really nice to chat with you about some of the work we've done.
For a video of the amazing rain frog that Katie described, head to the podcast webpage at claranorden.com/specimen stories. Katie also shared a video of another favorite, the terrifying display of a budget's frog, which you'll find there as well. Trust me, they're both well worth a watch. On the page, you'll also find a link to the paper we talked about in this episode, and links to learn more about Katie's research. This episode was recorded and produced by me, Clara Nodin, and the music was downloaded from purpleplanet.com and pixabay.com. If you have any thoughts or comments, or perhaps suggestions for who I should talk to next, let me know at specimenstoriespodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, goodbye!